Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Adam Zock, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic. And I knew just from our brief introduction here, I'm excited to chat with you more, Dan. Love what you got going on.
Yeah, you and me both. So let's start this with a little location stamp. I'm traveling in Philly, which is one of our main cities right now. Home is Chicago. Unless it's the wintertime, home is Florida. Whereabouts are you recording from now? Did you grow up there? And how did you land there?
Yeah, I am in North Dakota. Right now I'm in Fargo. I grew up in the western part of the state in a town of about 10,000 people. So now I moved to the quasi big city here in Fargo, which is 100,000 people, which is pretty much one square mile around you. It's probably about the same density spread out over 500 square miles here in North Dakota. And so I've been here my whole life. And that's where I first started doing investment properties, and now have investment properties in 57 cities and 25 states, doing some long distance investing, and just love everything real estate.
Nice. And I think from your bio, what's it been like 13, 14 years? It's been a while you've been doing this.
Yeah. So the first property I ever owned was a house hack in 2012, took a little bit of a hiatus, but really didn't start gearing up then until 2016, 2017. And then the last probably 5 years was probably the greatest growth. And so I've been doing real estate. Yeah. I could maybe stretch it and say a dozen years. But since that was the first property, but I would say mostly it's been the last 7 years.
Okay. And you've been buying, let's say, in the last 36 months since 2021, you bought a few properties in this time period?
Yeah. So I would say in the last 36 months, we have bought, I think, I don't know the exact number in the last 36 months, but I would say probably 52 homes. We're probably averaging at least one a month. And now the goal for 2024 is one home under contract per week.
Nice. Yeah. And I asked and couched that, because a lot of people pushed pause in 2022, and a lot of people are sitting here, we're on the sidelines, we're hanging out, and we're waiting, and we're not, you know, doing the business. And here you are still trying to put one per week into the portfolio in March of 2024, when, if I'm not mistaken, housing prices have like notched the highest they've ever been. Congrats.
Thank you.
So we have 100,000 people, and I make a joke about myself. I grew up in the Philadelphia region, and there's probably 5, 6, maybe 7 million people in like what would be our metro area. And then I moved to Chicago, and I think that's like 8 to 9 million in the entire metro area. I haven't checked the exact figures. I just know these are huge markets. And then I kind of spread out a little bit back in 2015, 16, 17, and tried to do Baltimore and tried to do Denver. We had an office in Tampa for a little while. We were in Miami for a little while, and we pulled back out of those markets. And I always was looking for the largest volume of people, like the highest density. And when I hear something like 100,000 people, like Fargo, it's amazing, but I feel like it would be tough to scale and do a deal a week in Fargo. And it sounds like you've dealt maybe with that challenge, and that was why you built the current business model that you're working now. And maybe you could elaborate on what that business model actually is.
For sure. I feel like everyone's sitting on something that's extremely unique to them. It might be that they make a good income. It might be that they know somebody. It might be that they happen to be in a good location, or you could take the potential negative of a low population and see that, you know, as a reason to not get into real estate. But I feel like everyone listening has some unique advantage that they know. Like, they know a specific housing market better than someone else. They know, you know, they maybe know a capital lender, or they know how to analyze a deal. And so I feel like that's what the person needs to leverage on the most to get into probably their next deal. And so you're really strengthening on that, because I feel like everything's just a calculated risk to reward. It's like everything's risky. And so all you're trying to do is convince yourself that the calculated risk is worth the reward. And a lot of times that's easy to do in your strength zone. And so that's what I started with. It was just whatever was easiest and most accessible. Because otherwise, if I was searching for the perfect deal, or if I just threw up my hands and said, hey, this isn't going to work, I would have gone from 0 to 0 and never done anything. So it's like going from 0 to 1, going from 1 to 2 to 3. And I'll say my deals 2 through 5 made me zero money. In fact, I probably lost money on them. It was just, I was getting in the reps and I wanted the single base hits to what I thought was a good deal. And so it was acting my way through it. But every single deal, I came up with the, well, I'm never doing that again list. And so it was, I'm not going to buy a home from 1910 and think I can renovate it for 15 grand. It was, I'm not going to buy a turnkey rental with tenants that I haven't screened before. Again, it's that I'm never going to buy a fourplex again that was, you know, off of Facebook Marketplace. And so like every deal came up with my, I'm never doing this again, but it was probably smaller deals that I was able to absorb it being a past civil engineer. But then every one of those stacked up to be like, I'm sick of buying properties. I don't have the capital. And so then that's where we slowly pivoted into version 1, which was we told college kids, go pick a house for rent and I'll buy it and you can rent it at the 1% rule. And so that was my way of cash flowing. It was go buy a $300,000 house and you can pay $3,000 a month in rent. And at that point, that was enough for me to cash flow about a 10 to 12% cash on cash ROI. And so the college kids picked out a home. Then I just got a home off the MLS, paid close to asking price for it. Nothing sexy, nothing off market. But then I had a tenant day one because I hated the turnovers and I hated the vacancy because I was like, 1 month vacancy just crushes your entire year from an ROI standpoint. And then, so we started doing that a little bit. And then it was like, oh, well, then they leave after a year and market rent isn't $3,000. Turns out market rent is $2,000. So I was like, well, all right. So I'm not doing that again because yeah, it'll generally appreciate, but I want cash flow. So that's where I first stumbled into Chris Krohn and then took Joe McCall's course and found Wendy Patton and these others that were doing lease option models where they were buying or they were actually doing sandwich lease options where they're basically leasing a home, have an option to buy, and then they were selling it on a lease with an option to buy. But and for the listeners that might not know what that is it's probably in the creative financing space. You know, you have the rental, you have the normal mortgage, and you can do seller finance, you could do a land contract, you could do a lease option. A lease option is probably the closest thing to a rental from a contractual standpoint that you can get. Land contract is closer to a mortgage, and then seller financing is, you know, typically true a debt position loan, you know, where the seller's carrying it back and you get to go on title. But on a lease option, the tenants are not on title. In Texas, you got to file the option agreement, but in all the other 49 states, it's typically just a lease with an option to buy. So what we started saying is, hey, same concept. People go buy a house. We'll buy it for you. You rent it. And then you have the exclusive option to buy anytime in the next 3 years. So my whole goal was I wanted to get that same cash flow day one, but then I didn't want to have to turn over the property and I wanted them to buy the house. So that's all we do every day, all day now here at Home Equity Partners, we're just buying homes for people that want to rent it and have the option to buy in the next 3 years, which happens to be a lot of people that either are moving, can't get a bank loan, don't have the debt to income, maybe are self-employed. And so there's some big players like Divvy Homes and Home Partners of America doing this in the larger cities. We just figured out that there's a lot of room because there's 110,000 people searching rent-to-own homes every single month into Google. And so we just tapped into that niche and are serving those individuals.
Wow. That's interesting. And the lease options, I mean, Wendy Patton, I remember these names from way back in like 2007, 2008, 2009, back in that time. And in 2011, I created a real estate brokerage and our whole thing was going to be these lease options similar to what you're doing. It kind of never really gained traction for me. It wasn't my sweet spot. And we never even closed a single deal to get it done. And on paper, these look great. What Divvy Homes is doing. I have a friend who works there, Home Partners of America, what you're doing. They look great, right? You get the tenant buyer in the property and then they cash you out at the end of that. And that's like super clean and gets it done. Does that how it actually works out in reality? Have you had many go full cycle on buying the property at the end of the 3 years?
Yep. So that's the biggest risk is, are they going to buy? That's the first question that everyone has to come up with. And so we've had the pleasure of seeing 28 8 deals going full cycle. Some bought, some didn't. We were at 80% buyback. Then we started trending down towards 50% with people not buying. And so now we're changing some different processes to make sure that no one wants to evict someone out of a home. It's just like, it's a lose for the investor. It's a lose for us. It's a lose for the client. And so a couple of different things that we used to stack it up, which was, you know, underwriting them at the beginning. But the idea is, what is stopping them from getting a mortgage? That's probably the biggest thing. Or are they using this as a test drive vehicle? Because I've seen people do a lease with an option to buy where they just say, if you got a 700 credit score and you pay me market rent and you just give me a 3-year lease, you can rent it or you can own it. I don't care which one, what you do. And so that's kind of the Home Partners of America model, which is they don't take any rent credits. They don't take a high option fee. It's just you get to rent or own. And it's a clear year 1 through year 5 monthly rent and a set buyback price that appreciates probably at like 5.5% per year. For us, our target audience is, I don't want the home back. I'm doing this in a different city every single time. And so I'm not just concentrated in Atlanta or wherever. It's any home, any city, assuming that someone has the income and the down payment. One way that we've used to protect our investors is the rent guarantee policy, because a lot of these, I was always wondering and scratching my head, how do the banks with 3.5% down and a 580 credit score not just get crushed, right? Because like, you would think that if they defaulted by 10%, the bank's like slow and moving. Like we're a group of real estate investors, right? We're pretty savvy, right? A tenant's not paying. It's like cash for keys. You can do the eviction. You could, you know, relist the home as a rental. You can sell it. You can basically like play the market. Whereas like a bank's like, nope, we go through the REO. Like we're just, it's gone, right? We're just liquidating the asset. We got no other options. Here's our system. Here's our process. And I was like, oh, they do private mortgage insurance and they make the tenant pay for it. So what we did is we just did the same equivalent and we found rent guarantee insurance. So there's the guarantors, there's LEAP, and then Single Key is now breaking into it. So we make every tenant pay for rent guarantee insurance and all the factors covered. But like that was, again, the same way of like a tenant moved out and I was like, oh, now we lost this high rent. Now we're kind of screwed. So these companies will guarantee their rent for X amount of months until you re-rent it or you sell it. And we found that's been a great, one of the few insurance policies that I don't mind paying for, or I guess that we make the tenant buyers pay for, depending on their risk profile, because that significantly helps the downside of what if they don't buy, or what if they move out, or what's that scenario. So happy to share more about that. But if you kind of know about those, I'm happy to share just for listeners that maybe don't know about that.
Yeah, that is interesting. So what if you do make the claim? Have you made some claims? Do you become like normally, if you make a claim on your property insurance, you get dropped the following year, your rates go up by 50%.
Yep.
So what happened when you made your first claim to LEAP?
I was shocked that they actually paid it out. So I went with LEAP and I was like, not that I wanted someone to move out because that was like the last thing, but I was like, yeah, we have all these insurance policies, but it's like homeowners insurance. Like, oh no, just kidding. On page 53, subsection A, it says we don't cover anything with water seepage. And you're like, well, that's everything, right? Like, it's like, so what LEAP does is they have a monthly premium and then they have a deductible, went through it, submitted the information, and they cut us a check for 2.5 months of lost rent and hit our bank account. And I couldn't believe it. And so LEAP went through the full cycle. I actually like the guarantor's bond policy a little bit more just from a overall coverage. We have not had to, and they have their own underwriting criteria. LEAP, anybody can get. You can just say, I want coverage on this one, and they don't do any underwriting, at least at the time of this recording. The guarantors, they actually screen everyone. So that, and then they're issuing a rental bond policy for that duration of it. And their kind of play is like, you don't need to collect a security deposit because here's this bond saying that we're going to pay it. Now, again, it's insurance. Whether or not they're going to pay it is, you know, kind of suspect, but that's the intent.
Okay. What type of cost is associated with that for your tenant? I mean, if the rent's $2,000 a month through LEAP or guarantors, what do you estimate that tenant now has to pay for that policy and for how long?
So for LEAP, let's say it's $2,000 a month in rent. Roughly $83 a month, and then call it 1 month's rent as a deductible. So it's like, well, if you lose them, their thing is like, okay, it, you know, maybe it takes you 60 or 90 days. And for us, since we're selling the home, like we're not re-renting it out. So like for them, I could kind of see like, well, they're kind of hoping everyone rents it out in 30 days and just never does a claim, right? Similar to like you get in a car wreck and if your deductible is $1,500 and they want the cost to be right at like $1,499 so that you don't have to do, you know, anything with it. So it's about $83 a month per $2,000 a month. And then they have that first month deductible. The guarantors is paid up front at roughly 1 to 1.5 one month's rent. And it's actually all paid up in front and that's it. No, at least that I know of, no premium, no deductible, no different things that you're paying after the fact.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. So 28 deals have gone full cycle and the tenant buyer has cashed them out. You have a handful of people that leave. You had mentioned that you can't re-rent the same property for that same rent. So you're falling into a little bit of the bind that you faced with the college kid rentals, Adam. When you sell that property, you said we're usually going to sell them. And it seems like you're kind of forced to sell it at that point. Is that regardless of whether you're in a profit position or a loss position, you're taking it and it's playing a numbers game with your portfolio? Walk me through that sell, re-rent decision and maybe some of the results, if you don't mind.
Sure. Happy to do that. So we started off this business just buying and holding all the assets ourselves. We created an LLC, and this is what we used to get out of both my business partners was in construction. I was in civil engineering. We did, you know, 20 to 30 of these deals. It's like, great. We got it. You know, it was kind of the financial independence and that was all the track I was on. There wasn't, you know, a whole lot of mission. It was just Adam wanted out of his job and it was extremely selfish, but mostly because I saw my first child get born and I was like, I want to spend a ton of time with him. To this day, this week, I'm going to spend probably 45 hours with my 6, 4, and 1 year old. And it is phenomenal. And I absolutely love that. And so that was the freedom I was chasing with this. And then once we did that, it was like, cool, how can I retire my fellow engineers? So then we started assigning it and turning it into a business. And so we'll still hold some deals. We'll assign deals to outside investors. And then we created a syndication for investors that don't want to take on a deal. They can get 5% of 20 deals. And so then we're either holding them, assigning them to individuals, or most of the time now putting it into our syndication fund just to guarantee that we have capital to buy these homes for people. Cause there can be some logistics on when we're buying a home in a different city every single time, lining up the debt financing, lining up the investor, making sure that what we promised the tenant buyer and basically gave them the equivalent of a bank pre-approval letter, but it's our rent to own pre-approval letter that no matter what, we're guaranteeing to get them a house, whether we do it ourselves, outside investor, or the syndication. And so of the homes that haven't gone full cycle, we've had probably half that have made us a lot of money and half that have not. And in general, my business partner, his rule of thumb is we bought this property for a reason and that reason is no longer served its purpose. And we basically took the calculated bet on red, right? And turns out we were right sometimes, we were wrong sometimes. And his point is, okay, we probably could rent it out and you could probably, you know, ride the wave because all of our loans are in a 5-year term, 25-year AM on a commercial loan. So we really want to be in and out of these deals in less than 5 years. And so we do have that 5-year window where for sure we're going to rent it or sell it. And I guess depending on what interest rates are, you know, we can always, you know, stretch it out and do a different term. But that's why we do a 3-year lease option. That gives them 3 years to buy it. If we need to, we can extend it for another year. But then by year 4, it gives us a year to either liquidate it, extend our terms with the bank. And so in general, real estate goes up. And so we've seen some markets where the tenants unfortunately left and we're going to make a lot of money on it. We've had others that have been more rural that we bought it at 265 and we just said listed at 240 and we'll just take the loss. And that's what happens. And we'll go. We've had other investors that are like, nope, I'm keeping the property. It's in a good area. I'm fixing it up. And I just have a property manager and we're just going to rent it and keep it. So our general philosophy, I guess my business partner, who's kind of the savvy brains behind it, cause I'm always like, oh, can we do this? Can we do that? He's like, just keep it simple. If they're no longer in the home, we don't want the home. And we bought this for a purpose. Now we're adding on the rent guarantee and different things. So the whole idea is heads we win, tails we break even. That's our model.
Okay. Yeah. I remember when I was working on my brokerage, Alternative Decision was the name of that. You can go scroll all the way back to 2011 and see some of the brokerage signs and some of the old basic posts that I put up back then. But part of our strategy was if that occurred to us, we wanted to have this like list of willing tenant buyers. Now, we were working in the Philadelphia market. So we were looking to kind of have this like focused brand power. I guess what Divvy would have tried to do, where now we can relist this as the lease option, ideally collect some option payment and re-tenant the property and kind of keep it moving. Again, I don't have any closed deals to show for that. And we walked away from that. So it's interesting to hear a level of discipline that's required for you and your business to say, okay, anyone on this call who's ever lost money on a flip usually prices it at first where they're profit, and then they're lower the price, and your holding costs suddenly exceed it. And now we find ourselves with the listing price and accepting an offer where we're taking the loss. And that's usually like 6 to 12 months worth of marketing time for us to come to grips with taking a loss on our property. I'm speaking from my own experience there now. But for you to go on at 240 and like you're willing to instantly take that loss, there's something to be said for that, because you're skipping this 6 months worth of extra carrying costs and this like mental gymnastics that I think, I'm sure it's not just me. I see these properties listed on the MLS where people pay too much for a flip. They spend too much in construction, and then they listed it really high, too high, because they were trying to break even or make some kind of profit. And that's probably the cardinal sin in that scenario that ends up costing them 20, 30, or 40% more loss than had they made the more disciplined decision that you did.
And so in addition to the home equity part, it reminds me of a story of some homes I bought in Bishop, Texas. So it not in that model, but where I'm a money partner on a joint venture for doing flips, where I bring the capital, they find the deal, and then we split the profits. I was like, here's a really awesome way of doing this. And as I was going through it, from the marketing side, it was, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to be the money partner and we're going to go through with this. And yeah, like it went like, oh, this is awesome. It's easy. It's uninformed optimism. Like you just do it. And then you get the one deal where I've been holding it for 13 months and I'm like, never again. I am not, holding this property. It's liquidated and we are done and we're going to get out of this.
Uninformed optimism. Oh, I can see that in my history here. Sure, it won't be the last time. What a great term for not a great situation.
Yeah, I learned it from a few other people, where it's like, everything just looks great, right? Where it's like, call it from anybody investing after 2009, maybe 2010 to roughly now, like it was pretty hard to lose money. There's probably a couple markets that with COVID that things probably went a little bit crazy and a little bit back, but in general, it was holy cow. How like a rising tide just lifted all boats.
That's right. So let's step back to the syndication fund now. How's that set up? If I were an investor in this fund and I was going to put in, I'm assuming I'd have to be an accredited investor and I'm going to put $100,000 in that fund. What should I expect? How long? What kind of return? What kind of risk do we have in there if I'm an investor?
Sure. So for syndications, we did our first syndication last year and we did a 12% preferred return with a 70-30 split, which essentially means that the first 12% of the profits of the capital. So let's say someone put, let's say that we raised $1 million, the first $120,000 of profits goes to the individuals, and they typically call them limited partners. That's their basically right of first access to the profits. And then everything after that is split 70% in favor of the limited partners and then 30% to what would be called the general partners. And we did what was called a 506B, which means that we can't publicly advertise, but that we, when we filled our last fund, it was, hey, we could have as many accredited investors as we want and about 35 sophisticated investors, and then there's some different rules that the securities attorneys have you follow for, verifying or doing the questionnaire. And so then we took that model and basically said, we were just hitting base hits all day, every day, right? It was just a single, not to the number of MLB hits that you're hitting in a year, Dan, from a volume perspective. But that was, having never done anything bigger than a fourplex, it was just a single family home at a time. And it was like, there was no grand slam deals. It was just the consistency and the volume of doing it. And so now this was just like, okay, well, how can we do this same thing faster? And that's kind of why I think a lot of people in single family eventually graduate to commercials. They're like, oh, I can do this. Well, if I'm gonna do the same level of effort, can I just do it bigger and, you know, go on bigger deals? But there's a little bit of complexity that comes with it. And so what we did is we found a good securities attorney, a good CPA, and basically said, hey, we have a group of 13 investors. We want to raise $1 million. Like, what would it look like if we just did all the work, you put in the capital, you got a preferred return. And if we make you over 12%, we get, you know, a share in that. And instead of them just taking on one deal where they get a 20% return, or, you know, maybe a negative 10% where there's more volatility, kind of like a stock market on whether the tenant buyer buys. But we just said, well, what if we just put 20 homes into that? And so you own 5% of 20 homes. And so now we're doing the same thing with our second fund. And we just want to prove out the concept. Securing debt financing is really tricky when you're going into multiple markets. So oftentimes you have to bring someone with a really big balance sheet, let the banks feel comfortable. And now we got local banks and credit unions. They're like, cool, you're good for $8 million. Go buy a home anywhere using this model. As long as it's a 75% LTV, we get a third party appraisal and it meets the 1.25 DSCR. Like, you're good to go, which was like, sweet. So now we can go buy $8 million of property, not having to worry about the debt, not having to worry about the capital. And it's all about the deal flow then. And we don't have to kind of match the capital. And we actually we're actually doing a staggered capital raise versus the traditional multifamily route, which is here's 190 unit. We're going to buy it for, you know, 53 million, put 12 million into it, and it's going to be worth 80. And they kind of know this, here's the single asset. Well, we go to the bank and they're like, what homes are you buying? We're like, don't know yet. They're like, where are you buying them? We're like, don't know yet. And they're like, oh, and you want how much? And it's like, well, trust me, like, this is our model. And so, like, it was a little bit of back and forth. And so what we're doing is we're having investors commit capital, but then contributing it over a period of time as we do our call, just to kind of match the capital with the deployment schedule. So we're saying, hey, our goal is to buy, you know, let's say it's three homes a week, three homes a month, whatever the number is. If we go less, if we go more, we can just accelerate our capital raise schedule or decelerate it depending on the deal flow. But we at least have the structure, the security filings and everything intact to make that happen. And hopefully I didn't go too far off the ranges, but happy to explain more there.
Yeah, it's a great roadmap there. How long would syndication fund number one run? Is it going to be here? We take the million, we buy 10 assets, and then as each of these 10 sell, your investor capital is distributed pro rata, or however much you put in pari passu, and that's the end of it. And it might only run 24 months. Or are you guys like, okay, we sold asset number one, now we're buying asset number 11. Okay, we sold asset number three, let's buy asset number, and then it runs for 10 years. How do you define the term of that fund? And I guess each fund going to go forward.
Sure. So the first fund, we said, hey, once we hit our raise, that was it. And then as the tenant buyers either bought or left, we're liquidating the asset, and then we're going to dissolve the fund, which was like kind of test run number one on a syndication realm. So we've done full cycle deals, and we're, you know, helping manage, you know, roughly 75, you know, lease option deals, you know, going at, you know, at one time. So it's like, we kind of understand the various pieces, but this one was like a clear start, middle, and end. It was raise, deploy, exit. Now we're going, okay, great. We figured out a little bit of the pieces. We got a little bit smarter, what works, what doesn't work. And so now the plan was, okay, let's do this 10 times bigger. We'll buy for the first 5 years. Then we'll return all the investors' capital in the next 2 years. And then after that, we're basically playing with free money, and we can either dissolve the company and liquidate it and end at roughly 10 years, or depending on what our investors want to do, since they've got all their capital back and all their preferred return, they're essentially just, we're splitting the profit share, you know, on the upside. And so we could turn it a little bit more evergreen, which is where securities attorneys love to drill up the time on all these what if scenarios of if someone dies, if you do this, if you do that. And I'm like, I feel like attorneys are just trying to make things complicated. I get that they're trying to protect us, but a little bit of a personal gripe where it's like, I feel like the interests are disaligned. We're a results oriented workforce where it's like we pay for results versus paying them for their time. So as much time as they can bill, you know, so I feel like it's a little bit disincentivized, but overall having a good securities attorney, having a good, CPA is going to save you a bunch. But it's been very interesting being right in the trenches of like, oh, here's our operating agreement and our private placement memorandum, and here's the 97 different scenarios that can come out. And I'm so much for like the let's go, let's go, let's go. And so luckily I've got some general partners who are a lot smarter than me. They understand a lot of this. And so my kind of quiver, the arrow to get things started matches well with their ability for stability and understanding kind of the long-term play.
Oh, now the securities attorneys are probably $350 to $550 an hour. And aren't the civil engineers like $350 to $550 an hour?
Yeah, maybe we could just trade time for money there.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys are going through all those scenarios. Well, what if we have 24,000 cars per day here? Are we going to need this alternative turn lane or the slowdown lane? I mean, what about if this other, you know, fire hydrant is just a little too far from this shopping center? We might need another.
Yeah, and have you thought about this? And what about that? And ooh, would you like a cost proposal on this?
That's right. That's right. I digress. That's interesting. It sounds really, really interesting. Are there any tax benefits for the syndicator? Do you guys pass along any depreciation of any sort to people going into the fund on the front end?
For sure. So yeah, so we've done this. This is our third technically securities filings. Our first one was unsecured promissory notes, which was strictly just 1099 interest that the investors would get, not secured, which is a whole nother interesting way of doing it. Most of them just don't do securities, give them a first position. You don't have to deal with the securities attorney, but ask me how I know, I got a fun story behind that and talking with the North Dakota securities office on Adam, just trying to figure out life and literally calling them up and being like, hey, this is what I'm doing. They're like, hey, you shouldn't be doing that, you know, type thing where it's like, oh, I probably should know. So it's like, you can do the securities unsecured where it's like, it's not even tied to any debt. It's basically just a business loan where they're just saying, hey, take the money, go do with it as you want as operating capital, super flexible from a business perspective. If they're in the syndication, we're issuing K-1s. So everyone's getting depreciation when they're a limited partner, because it's essentially just an LLC with different units or different members in it. And so for ours, it's literally just one LLC, one operating agreement, two different class units. All of the tax benefits get passed on. So like, hey, on this first fund, we've paid out money, but they're going to show a paper loss on their K-1 because we were acquiring assets in a year. There was acquisition fees there. You get the depreciation, but they're still getting the cash flow from that asset.
Okay. Makes sense. So let's switch gears one more time. We have the finding of tenants. It seems, I don't know, interesting, maybe even somewhat odd to me that you have 57 cities and 25 states. It's like, well, why not just go deep on one particular market and, you know, codify your brand there and maybe get some momentum? And you probably have a much broader, better answer and reasoning for why and how you guys now own in 57 cities and 25 states. Would you mind touching on the, because tenants must be one of the core strengths of what you're doing. This doesn't happen without the tenant buyer being interested and having the faith that you're going to do what you said you're going to do. And then ideally they're doing what they said they were going to do.
100%. The short answer, Dan, is if I was a better business owner, I would be able to knock this out in a state. That's what the big boys are doing. Home Partners and Divvy. They're like, I'm picking my market. I'm picking the top 25 metros with the highest population, and I'm going to own those cities. Adam, being the scrappy North Dakotan that I am, I was like, how can I get tenant buyer leads? Okay, I try it in Fargo. Okay, I didn't really get anything. Okay, well now I have to go long distance. So what do I do? And I was like, okay, well, what's the most effective way? Just because there wasn't the same volume here, either from Adam's a poor marketer or just purely from a numbers perspective on 100,000 people versus 8 million people, on trying to find that sweet spot of those people that specifically want to do a rent to own home. And so I was like, well, if I'm going long distance anyways, or longer distance, like what's the most effective way? And that's where I got deep into Google Ads and pay-per-click. And so now I honestly just raise and lower the ad budget on our Google Ads, and they're just targeting our specific person. And we have them fill out a pre-qualification form of what's your income, what's your credit score, how much do you make, what, here's the expectations, this is your monthly payment, here's what you'd be approved for, do you like this, yes or no? And if they click yes, Google gets really happy and awards it a conversion point. And so then they give us more of those leads. If they say no, Google doesn't give us a conversion point. And so similar to, you know, the shopping for people that are trying to sell their home fast, it's like, yeah, it's just, you're kind of just doing the conversion value. And the former engineer in me, I just love numbers, and Google is just so easy to track those numbers. We played with Facebook a little bit. We're looking at doing Zillow potentially next, but Google is just, it's such an easy way of tracking literally like number of views, number of clicks, click-throughs, how far they went down your funnel, what's your cost per conversion, and then you can kind of start back calculating, like, okay, this is how the numbers work. So what we do is we just target specific states, and we let Google do its thing with our ad budget, and they're just specifically trying to find the most attractive way of spending our ad budget for the lowest cost per click.
Yeah, and that's really cool because it gives you this opportunity over time. If you guys do fall in love with certain areas, certain markets, certain states, the tenant laws are favorable in half the states, and they're not in the other half, and you fall out of love or fall into hate with certain ones, you just turn the state off and you shut off the lead flow. Imagine over time, you will find more of your most desirable markets and want to like scale up much more heavily in that area. So that explains the tenant.
And if you don't mind, yep. Dan, one thing that I think the listeners could do is, if you know anyone who's self-employed or can't get a bank loan, like this was the very first kind of model one that I did. It was basically like, I'm just trying to co-sign with someone. And if I have to put in no money, but I maybe get $250 or $500 of cash flow, like that's a potential real estate play there. Is like you're kind of co-signing on a loan, which is kind of the equivalent we're doing. We just like to take title so that we have more control. But if a listener is looking at it and be like, hey, I have a really good job, or I have a good W-2 income, and I can get a bank loan in about 5 seconds from 12 different banks, because it's typically if you have the W-2, I would say that there might be a lot of, sometimes they're real estate agents, sometimes they're flippers, sometimes they're self-employed, sometimes they're people with, you know, poor credit score, but it's like, you can kind of work out either a tenants in common and an LLC, or, you know, this type of arrangement. You could do a land contract where you're just like, hey, they're literally bringing 20%, you're putting 20%, just matching your conventional loan, you know, selling it back to them and just say, hey, you're responsible for principal, interest, taxes, insurance, repairs, all that. Just use my loan, but then just give me a yield spread, which is kind of like what the banks are doing. They're just borrowing money and lending it out anyways. And it's like, oh, could you borrow at 7 and lend it out at 9 and just take your 2% yield spread? And so just for anyone listening, there's kind of another different way if your brain haven't thought it, because like I was always wondering how the banks always had the biggest buildings in downtown. It's like, oh, it's because they're just playing the yield spread game where they're just kind of moving money around and playing the spread.
Yeah, and some of them go belly up. That's right. It can be a dangerous game. What price points areas are a no-go for you, right? Is there an area where you have this tenant, it's got the income and they're willing, but you're like, we're not doing this on a $900,000 house? Or what other example is a no deal for you?
So for us, we are starting to collect all the data to figure out what deals do and don't work. And so we've actually recently stumbled across a couple interesting statistics across 25 states, which was homes under 200,000 typically tend to perform worse, which I thought was an interesting statistic. And it's partially because if you're getting 5 or 10% down, if you do it on a $100,000 house, it's $5,000 or $10,000. But if you do it on a $400,000 house, that's $20,000 to $40,000. And so the amount of, call it skin in the game, although from a same percentage basis is the same, just from a pure dollar amount is much higher. So we've kind of found our sweet spot being between 200 and 650,000, mostly in the Midwest to Southeast.
And people in that price point too, I mean, just think about it. It's like the size of their monthly budget from the kind of work they've done for that income is going to allow a little bit more tolerance for the car repair that's needed, for the 2 weeks out of work because you're sick, right? A little bit more savings versus somebody who is maybe in that 200K or under mark, like, man, they're done when the car breaks. Car needs transmission, like they're out. They can't get to work. It's, you know, it's shut everything down. So there's a lot more risk as you get to that level, unfortunately. So I'm going to switch gears because we're getting here towards the end. And I was doing some research and something jumped out on one of the documents I think I found. Do you have a history playing chess?
Certainly do. My dad flew me around, taught me when I was young, kind of stopped playing when I started to beat him. But then I ended up taking the state chess champion 3 out of the 4 years in high school. And then was probably some of my favorite memories with my father, which was him, my first plane ride ever out of North Dakota to California to play in the national championship. And so there's just so many analogies in life for chess from like a delayed gratification and strategically moving forward that I've been slowly trying to get my kids. And they're like, ooh, a horsey. And I'm like, no, that's not what the lesson I'm trying to teach you, right? Like I'm trying to teach you like a life lessons and how to think five moves ahead and how to see the board. And so that's a good deep dive by you. I thoroughly enjoy chess. It's probably my number one hobby.
Yeah. And I did not play competitively anywhere at your level, and I was okay at chess. But I do remember playing probably starting when I was maybe 5 or 6 years old, something like that. And I wonder, it's like I am running a business and there's this level of complexity and we have to think ahead and we're having to calculate risk and we're having to come up with strategy. And it's like, should parents really consider making sure the kid plays chess, because you're mapping out the brain in a way at a very early age, right? The brain grows like the trunk of a tree, and then the branches go out, and the branch is really small in your early years. And then you can kind of like build out all the leaves, right? All the foliage on the branches of the brain. That's how the brain sort of grows its pathways. And I wonder how impactful or important something like chess, and I'm sure there's a lot of other things that could be done in place of chess to kind of expand the neurology at an early age as well. So it may not just be limited to chess. But, you know, how important is that to setting up the foundation in the neurology for that strategy and for that risk calculation, delayed gratification and these things, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later? And I haven't played chess. I haven't played chess in, you know, a decade, 20 years probably. But I probably would credit that as a child playing that all the way up through middle school, maybe a little bit into high school, as there was something that was important. It was maybe as important as reading books. I don't know.
Yeah. And oh man, I could go deep into this. And so you'll have to cut me off, but it was like, there's so many different things. So each chess piece typically has a point. A pawn has one, a horse has three, a rook has five, a queen has nine. So it's essentially like a queen is worth nine pawns, or two rooks are kind of the equivalent of a queen. And so as you're making trades or exchanges, you're trying to exchange a one piece to capture a higher piece. You basically have more points on the board. But what's unique about chess is that you could be all the way down to your last two pieces and still put your opponent in checkmate if you use their own pieces against them. And so it's partly kind of like a points base, but it's also just where you're at on the field, you know, with the pieces and how you use them to potentially get them into checkmate, along with the opportunity that every pawn can become a queen, which is just this really cool concept of like every little person, you know, can basically make it with enough, you know, if you make eight squares and you get to the other side, you can get promoted into the queen and you now become the most powerful piece on the board. And so that idea of sitting and looking at a chessboard and in my mind, like the pieces were literally moving around. It's funny. I watched The Queen's Gambit and was, you know, one of my favorite shows, because like that's, you're trying to look at a board and it's got pieces and different things. You're trying to do, oh, if I do this, then he's going to do that. If I do this, she'll do that. And if I do this. And so, yeah, just starting that chemistry of like, well, instead of just moving this piece and kind of seeing what's going to happen, it's really that forward thinking, which I think is ingrained into me, which is just, I wake up and I'm like, okay, where am I headed? Which can be a little bit of a downfall if that's all you're looking at, right? If you don't get to, you know, sit and smell the roses and enjoy the journey a little bit, just from kind of a philosophical and emotional intelligence health standpoint. But I do feel like people are better served if they say, hey, what can I sacrifice today for the betterment of tomorrow? And it's trying to make that kind of that strategic choice.
Fantastic. So I have a couple wrap-up questions that I ask every guest who comes on the show. Before we get to that point, knowing everything we've covered so far about Home Equity Partners and your business model, are there any points you feel like it would be important for us to cover for the listeners, or anything we left out here that might be worth revisiting before we switch gears completely?
I think you covered them all, Dan. I think the only thing I would reinforce is that for someone looking at their next deal, my favorite thing is just to look at what that calculated risk is and how you can mitigate that risk with something that you know, with a piece of knowledge, with a resource, with a business partner. I'm such a fan of business partners. I know Dave Ramsey craps on them all the time, where he's like, you know, the only ship that doesn't sail is a partnership. I don't care if all six of my business partnerships go south in 10 years. it was the best, besides getting married, having kids and different things like business partnerships, when you got someone with an equity interest similar to yours. And so in Home Equity Partner and my various ventures, I have a 50-50 business partner, and it's one of the greatest choices I've made. And so it can be a little bit smoke and fire, but those individuals that are like, man, it's just really hard to do it myself. One, you know, pay to get in front of masterminds and classes and different things. I'm in four of them. I took different classes. If you can do the lower price points, free is even better. Podcast, books, different things. But really, if you're looking at this and you find someone who's equally passionate and similar vision, but maybe complementary values, I would say that significantly increases your likelihood. Similar to my wife and I parenting. It's like, if one of us makes a bad choice, that's fine. But if both of us, like between the two of us, rare is it that we make a bad decision, right? Adam can get heated. My four-year-old pulls out, you know, dumps a bowl of Cheerios right in front of my face and then takes off his pants and runs away. And I'm just like scratching my head, or maybe I lose my temper. But like, as long as like both of us don't lose it. And so that's what I feel like in a strategic business partnership, not just the team member or employee mindset, is they really have that same kind of philosophy. And so for the listeners thinking about doing that, find your friend, find your uncle, find a sibling, find an investor, and see if there isn't some good complementary ads there.
Yeah. And I would layer on to that. Like, I have partnerships, and everybody who's on the team, we kind of say that, look, we're doing each deal. Our acquisition manager and the executive who's on that deal, as well as myself, like, we're all going to get a partnership share on that. These are not like our employees, our sales guys, and you're getting this like small, minuscule percentage, right? Show up and match the energy of your partners. And I would say that the complementary risk, two things. You want to have your alignment of interests in the partnership. That's how everybody feels like they're getting a fair shake. And part of that is, how much energy am I bringing to the table, right? Adam, you get someone who's like, oh, I got their cash, so you're going to get 10% of the deal and you're going to do all the work. And maybe some new investor takes that, and maybe there's some place where that's good enough because they were happy with the experience, and the experience was like, all right, my interests are aligned, I could spend time with this person. But in some of those instances, more often than not, maybe the cash is 60% and 40% in your interests are aligned. Maybe it's 50-50. I don't know, right? And for each person, your experience level, the quality of the deal, the other options, the other partner who's bringing that deal to the table might have at their disposal. You know, alignment of interest and really thinking through the incentives versus what each person's bringing to the table is really important. And you don't just want to partner with someone that, you know, has the same idea and is trying to do the same thing. There should be some evaluation of the strengths. I was just talking about this on our last episode of the show. Like, we should evaluate what strengths we're bringing to the table, because the bad partnerships that I've been a part of, that I've had to get out of, were most often caused when the energy wasn't being matched, or, you know, all of our interests were aligned and the energy was there, and then the person maybe got into some other business and now they're spending more time on that than this. And I feel like I'm carrying 70% of the load where it was supposed to be 50-50, because we were 50-50 in the early days. And maybe the other person feels like that, and you're the guy putting 10% in, or the gal putting 10% in, and it's time, you know, to exit that partnership. So evaluate the strengths and make sure the interests are aligned would be my personal take on selecting the right partners. Cool. Our wrap-up questions here. Adam, do you have any books, podcasts, sources of inspiration, maybe one or two recommendations that might fit in that category for the listeners?
I would say Scott Trent's Set for Life. If you're in the early stages, just talking about how to manage your expenses and how to save up and cash flow. If you're a business owner, The Road Less Stupid by Keith Cunningham will change your philosophy on business. It's so crazy what just simple questions can do. But that one's a rare one that I've been recommending to everyone recently, especially if you own a business.
The Road Less Stupid. What a great title. Cool. Crown jewel of wisdom. You're still a civil engineer, but now you know everything you know now, March of 2024. Adam, if you could go back and tell yourself earlier in that civil engineering career, that crown jewel of wisdom, what would that gem be?
So in this specific case, I got to financial freedom and I thought that was it. Like, I left the engineering job and I probably had an identity crisis where it was like, cool, like, I've worked 10 years to get out of this job, which is like, it was my whole life. For 10 years, I had small businesses, I had small kids, I got married and do that. But the whole idea was like, I got bigger pockets. I got the fire mode. I was living, breathing financial independence, and I was going to leave the W-2 job. And like that, that was it. Like there wasn't anything beyond that. And so it's really difficult to understand, but I would look back and I would say, I was so passionate and fired up and thrilled about it. And oftentimes, and there was a couple times where I looked at it, but I was like, this is potentially the best time in your life. And for everyone listening, like this is potentially the best time in your life. Everyone struggles. Everyone has problems. If you put all your problems on the table, you'll probably be pretty quick to take back your own if you were in your own neighborhood when you realize what other problems people have. But I would say this is likely the best time in your life. You're starting a business, you're raising a family. Like I got great energy, I got great health versus all the, I'm not out of the job yet. I don't have this. And us high charging, you know, high, you know, impact entrepreneurs, it's always from A to B. And so it's like, just really sitting down and enjoying it and being like, hey, this is probably the greatest time in life. You got a lot of love, you got a lot of passion, a lot of fire, a lot of good opportunities and a lot of good optimism. Like enjoy it.
I love it. Where can listeners go to dig into you, Adam, or maybe Home Equity Partners?
For sure. So you can find me on LinkedIn and Facebook. If you just search Adam Zach, and it's Z-A-C-H, it kind of sounds like Zach, but it's pronounced Zach. And then if you go to homeequitypartner.com, you'll find a lot about what we're offering to tenant buyers. There's an investor tab on there, or you feel free to send me an email, adam@homeequitypartner.com.
And one, my final question, what is the kindest thing that anyone has ever done for you, Adam?
So when I was 28 years old, so roughly six years ago, I slowly started to understand that I was going blind. I got a genetic best disease, and my wife, when you start realizing that you might lose your vision, and the amount of empathy and compassion that she had, you know, just the trust that she had in me, it wasn't like this grand gesture. It wasn't this, hey, I'm going to do X, or like I was really in a tough spot. It was ironically just the idea that I have someone who truly loves me and is there for me for eternity, especially in the fact that I was worried that I was not going to get to see my kids' faces as I get older and I'm getting eye injections and doing different things. But just having her in my life and being able to share that with no one else on planet Earth, her ability to simply sit there and empathize and show kindness just as I was going through maybe the turbulence and the struggle of trying to grasp with, you know, life without, you know, little eyesight would be like, is the greatest gift that she gave me, was just having someone to be there for me.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, I'll be praying for fantastic eyesight for your entire life here as a close. But Adam, A lot of great stuff here written down on my notes. I had a blast. I'm sure we could have gone for another hour or two on this whole variety of topics. Maybe we'll have to do a follow-up at some point, but I appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much, Dan. It was a pleasure.
The REI Diamond Show is sponsored by Diamond Equity Investments, a private equity firm focused on buying and selling residential and commercial property throughout the United States. If you are an accredited investor seeking double-digit returns, you can sign up to review Diamond Equity's passive investment opportunities at www.fundrehabdeals.com. And if you're an investor who is seeking deals that you can buy, fix, and flip, please go to www.dealswithroi.com.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.